worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. We have open talk to begin the program today. We have guests who will be joining us later. And as I told you yesterday, I guess for the past couple of days, I mentioned that Adrian Owen is going to be on with us later on the program today for a discussion of the border between life and death. It's a fascinating subject. Adrian Owen is a neuroscientist, and he's been for years researching the gray area between what it's more than a coma. It's what some people describe as a vegetative state that some people are in alive, but are they really there? He's got some fascinating research to talk about. I'm almost mesmerized by it. We'll be talking with him later on the program today. And we have other guests who have visited with us as well. But open talk to begin with, and my goodness, the news that we have going on today. Wow. But open talk, that means you choose the subject, so feel free. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. And let's get right to the people here without any further ado. Hi there, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Yeah, beautiful day today, Dave.
Gorgeous. A few clouds right now, but I'm not going to argue with that. It's nice to have a return of the summertime temperatures, eh?
Yes, it is. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, what I have to ask is, when they put the new transformer in, does it have less of an area that it broadcasts out to?
No.
I just wonder because when I take my car up to my mother's up Slippery Rock, I don't get any reception from the stone house up Slippery Rock, and my mother can't get any at her house.
There are dead zones for certain areas and for certain radios, quite frankly. But that has to do with the topography more than anything else.
Okay, I just wonder because she's listened to your program for years and years, you know, probably as long as you've had it, and she's kind of disappointed because she can't get it anymore. So I don't know whether maybe another radio or something, but I know we used to get it up there, and we can't get it now.
Does she have a computer?
No.
Oh. Well, you can listen online if you have a computer anywhere. So I was going to offer that as a solution for her, but if she doesn't have one, that won't work.
Well, she couldn't see to use it anyway, but I just wanted to let you know. You know, my mother, she was on your ship. She wasn't at your facility there, but you talked to her on the phone about a book she wrote, Homespun Memories. Few years ago, and
I remember it. Yes, I remember it.
Yeah, she's been a faithful listener for years and years. So I don't know whether we'll have to maybe get a better radio for her or what. I don't know, but I know she's always gotten it for years. So I just wanted to find out if there was any less reception.
No, in fact, it's just the opposite. To be honest with you,
okay,
it's more.
All right, we'll have to see what we can do then on our end of it. Then
sure. Thanks, my friend. Nice to talk to you, by the way. And tell your mom I said hi, will you?
I will, yes. Thank you. And you have a good day.
And you. Thanks. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Yes, we installed a new transformer, much more powerful transformer, actually. It was late this winter, I guess. Spring? I don't know exactly when. March? Somewhere back in there. February, March. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525, the number here on the program today. And in the news, passage in the state Senate, not yet in the House, but in the state Senate, of a bill authored and sponsored by one of our local state senators, Senator Don White. And it's a bill, the bottom line is it will allow teachers to take their own guns to school. Allow teachers to take guns to school. And it passed the Senate yesterday on a vote of 28-22. It was not specifically along party lines. So if you're thinking about that, it's not a partisan issue. But obviously, it was a close vote. You know, there are some concerns, 28-22. And now it goes on to the State House. Who knows what the fate might be there. Governor Wolf has indicated that he is opposed to it and that if it reaches his desk in his current form, he will veto it. The Pennsylvania State Education Association, that's the state teachers union group, opposes it strenuously. They say they don't think it's a good idea. In fact, they said they find the idea of school personnel carrying firearms inside school buildings to be very disconcerting. What do you think? Should teachers be permitted to take their own guns to school? 283-2525. Senator White, for his part, and we had these quotes for him on the air this morning, he says this is not a Second Amendment issue. He says it doesn't have anything to do with that. He says it's for school safety. 283-2525 is our number. Let's get back to the people here today. 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi.
Hi.
I have the same problem that that man said his mother had. I can't get...
Where do you live?
In Conakonessy.
Okay. Well, I don't know what the problem is. We have not experienced any problems. So.
Well, then when we drive out of the garage, there's static before we get out of the garage. Once we get out of the garage, then I can get a station.
Well, you know, there are all sorts of electrical devices. I was listening to the Pirate game a couple of nights ago. Well, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago. And I pulled into McDonald's to get a cheeseburger. And as soon as I got close to the, you know, the booth where you pay and the person wears the wireless headset, interference on my radio. So it was obviously from the radio signal of the person who was taking orders and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I drove away from the restaurant, it disappeared. So there's all sorts of electrical, anything that is emitting RF, radio frequency. Garage door openers are one thing that I might suspect straight away, but there's all kind of things that do that today.
Well, I could get FM.
Well, that's a different... That's frequency modulation. It's different than than AM. FM radio is not affected by thunderstorms, for example, but AM radio is. If you've ever had a big thunderstorm coming up and you hear the crackling, you know, on the radio, you don't get that on FM. By the same token, FM doesn't go nearly, it doesn't travel nearly as far as AM does. One other thing I noticed, I have a portable radio. It's a pretty good one. Digital and so on and so forth that I use sometimes. And if I get it within about 5 feet of my cell phone, tremendous interference. In fact, you can't listen to it if you get it within 5 feet of your cell phone. So
here's another thing. I live in a condo now in Conakonessy,
mm-hmm.
and the lady across the street, her radio worked over here at my place, and at her my radio worked over her place.
That's goofy, huh? Yeah, well, there's a variety of things that can affect radio signals. Sometimes inside of buildings, if you're in a huge office building, a large office building, and depends on the structure of steel beams and concrete and that sort of thing, that can have an effect.
So. Well, when we first moved here, the radio was fine.
Well, I can tell you no more than what I've told you right now.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. 283-2525 is the number. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Yeah, Dave. I was wondering if you knew what was going on Route 8 on the other side of the viaduct where they're digging up all the ground.
You mean across from, like, Max Cafe there?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's the area where people who have lived around here for a long time will remember... That used to be a gas station in there.
Yeah.
It was, do you remember? It was Highway Oil, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Highway Oil. It was tucked into a little cubby hole there in the side of the hill. The gas station's been long gone. Police used to hate that place because it would get robbed all the time.
You know, oh, yeah.
It was down there by itself with no lights, and they were always having to investigate a break in there. But it's long gone. I don't know. The only thing that I've noticed is whatever is a project that is pretty slow-paced.
Yeah, but they're digging out quite a bit of ground. It seems like it cause a problem above it. You know, there's a road above it. I just wondered.
Don't know. Couldn't tell you. No. Don't know.
No, maybe somebody will call in and know.
I've wondered about it myself, though, to be honest with you. The last time I looked, I was having breakfast at Max, and I was looking out the window, and the piece of heavy equipment, the digger that they were using, it looks like it's old and rusted up. And I said, "Oh gosh, where'd they get that bulldozer? I mean, it really looked pretty decrepit, to be honest with you." So I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
Thanks, my friend. Anybody else know what's going on there? Somebody asked a couple of months ago what was going on in the property right up above where the Friedman's used to be. Way, way back where the old Kmart used to be in the Point Plaza, where there was a forested area there, and a huge growth of pine trees that were all cut down this past winter, I think, cleared out, and I don't know. Property owner apparently just is, I don't know, are they planning to develop it or what, but don't know. 283-2525 is the number. Hi, caller, this is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn. Hello? Hello? No one there. Okay, we'll go to this line next. Hi, caller, this is Dave.
Being able.
Yes, go right ahead. It's your turn.
About the teachers being able to have carry guns in the school.
Yes, what do you think?
I understood that it was not only the teachers, but all staff, you know, the administrators, the janitors, everyone would be able to carry a gun. I personally think it's a terrible idea, and my question, who's going to pay for the training of these people?
Well, school district, obviously, you know.
Yeah, well, we have enough problems with our school district and all of their expenses, you know, with the water and everything else. It seems like this would be a waste, and not only that, my concern would be that one of these people may lay their gun somewhere and a child would pick it up and look at it and it would be loaded and somebody would end up being shot.
Yeah, that's a concern I think that a lot of people have. Those who support the thing, support the legislation, say, well, they could lock the gun in a cabinet or a desk or whatever, but, you know,
they could lock it in a cabinet and forget to lock it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean,
the kids are going to know where they are, let's face it.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like we're late with the budget, as usual, and the legislators ought to be spending their time trying to figure out a budget instead of coming up with these stupid bills. That's all I have to say.
Appreciate your thoughts. Thanks for sharing them with us, my friend. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. 283-2525, a caller who's definitely not in favor of Senator White's bill. Let's go to this line. Hi, caller. Dave here. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, Dave. How you doing, buddy?
Just fine. Nice to talk to you. Nice to have you with us today.
Great. Hey, about the signal there on the radio, sometimes I'll go down to a friend's house down there in Natrona by the river, and I'll get it there, but it's state. You know what I mean? I can still get the signal there, but, you know, that's a long way. That's 22 miles I'm traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And about the work going on about the tire down there across the road.
Yeah, you know what that is?
I got a friend that's working piece over there at Max, and he's telling me that they're putting a tire storage building over there to what? Store their tires.
Oh, okay. So it's some kind of a storage building?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to go all the way up, I guess, to where the Butler Tire building is sitting now with that.
Well, the thing that we're talking about is on the other side of the road from Butler
Tire. Yeah, yeah. They're going to take and clear that land all the way up to where the original tire shop is on across the street.
Wow.
Yeah, they're going to clear that all off there. That whole hillside is going to be gone.
It's going to be a pretty big project then, when it's all finished.
That's what I found out about that there. So I'll let you go.
Good to know. I appreciate you sharing the info with us, my friend.
All right, thank you, Dave.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. 283-2525 is our number. Open talk today, 283-2525. Hi there. This is Dave. Thanks for waiting. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, David. Hey.
Hello.
How you doing today?
I'm just fine. Good to talk to you.
Oh, great to hear. Hey, David, I don't know if anybody has brought this subject up, but it's a real positive to me and our community. My mind's going on me. Bill May did a presentation about 2 weeks ago about the movie theaters down in Alameda Park. This man is so gifted with his knowledge and his research that he is able to do on these subjects. He talked about theaters from way back in the early 1900s. And there's a couple that you, maybe before your time, the Majestic Theater and the Capitol Theater.
Mm-hmm.
You probably remember the other theater. Of course, we all know about the Penn Theater. But he gave so much information as well as pictures. It was unbelievable. This man just does a fantastic job.
Well, he's not only a great researcher, he's a great storyteller. He makes it interesting, doesn't he?
Oh, he sure does.
Yeah.
He told a story. There was, and I'll abbreviate it because I know you have other callers who want to talk. But he told a story about a lady named Joan Cheeseman from Butler that was a movie actress. And he showed a film clip of her in a movie with Jimmy Stewart. And she lived in the house right down from the First Methodist Church, a beautiful white house right past the First Methodist on McCain Street.
Hmm.
And she was born and raised there. Her movie name was Joan Chandler. How Bill found this information, I have no idea. But it's just fantastic. And you know he's done the one on Alameda Park itself, as he called Butler's Disney World, as well as the Biddle Boys. He's done the Ghost Walk tours. This gentleman is truly outstanding. And if people get the opportunity, and he repeats these programs, they should definitely go. There were over 300 people down there at the movie theater night.
I agree. He's a treasure. Yeah.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. 283-2525, 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, Dave.
Hi.
In answer to your digging across from Butler Tire.
Yes, uh-huh.
I was told from a fairly reliable source, Butler Tire person said he's going to put a tire warehouse over there.
Mm-hmm. That's what somebody else just told us a couple of minutes ago, that it was going to be a storage facility, a warehouse for the tire shop right across the street.
Yeah that's what I think Max Cafe told me that, matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was obviously private property because, as I mentioned to an earlier caller many, many years ago, there was a little service station in there. It was kind of a hole-in-the-wall service station.
But it was a very busy one.
It was, yeah. It was called Highway Oil, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember stopping there plenty of times. So, okay, well, thank you, and have a very nice holiday weekend.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Yes. Holiday weekend, really? I'm talking to more and more people that I guess they're taking a vacation day on Monday and making it a 4-day holiday weekend. Well, hey, if you can do that, if you can see your way clear to do that, that's great. You know. So, in fact, yesterday somebody mentioned to me they got that holiday weekend feeling. I said, it's Wednesday. But then they were doing that. They were taking Monday off and making it a 4-day holiday. Well, good. That's great. Hope the weather stays good for you. Hope it stays warm, for one thing. I've had enough of the June cold snap that we experienced at the first part of this week. Phone number 283-2525. 283-2525 is the number. State Senator Dan White, who represents parts of our listening area, authored a bill that was approved by the State Senate yesterday that will, in so many words, obviously, it's a lengthy bill, but it will allow teachers to take their own guns to school. Senator White says it is not a second. Let me quote him exactly. I don't want to paraphrase him here. Quote, to be clear, this bill is not about the Second Amendment. It's about permitting the 500 school districts of this Commonwealth to have greater choices when it comes to protecting our most precious resource, our children, end quote, Senator White. The reaction has, it's controversial. There's no question about it. The PSEA, that's the umbrella group over all of the teachers' unions, almost all of the teacher union in Pennsylvania, has already come out opposing the bill. Dolores McCracken, the vice president of the PSEA, said that their group finds the idea of school personnel carrying firearms inside school buildings to be very disconcerting. She said in a statement, "I don't know that they would be able to react properly in a crisis situation. Our goal is to keep guns out of school, not put guns into schools." Now, there are some school districts. One of them is Butler. Butler Area School District, I know for sure. I think there might be a couple of others in our area as well. Since the Newtown shooting where the kindergarten and first grade kids were murdered up in Connecticut a couple of years ago, the Butler Area School District has hired retired state police troopers. And they obviously have training with weapons, and they are armed, and they are security guards, and there's at least one of them in every building in the Butler Area School District. To the best of my knowledge, they're all retired state troopers. And, you know, if you go to any event, you see them. Oh, basketball game or whatever you're at in any of the school buildings, they're there. Is that a reassuring presence? Some people would say it is indeed, you know, especially when they're retired state troopers. Not all school districts have the money to do that. That's one of our earlier callers pointed out. And quite frankly, that's what State Senator White pointed out as well. He said many rural school districts don't have the funds to hire trained personnel. Now, the bill does require that anybody who's going to do this would have to undergo training and so on. Even that's going to cost money, as one of our callers pointed out. I don't know. Is it a good idea or not? 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. What do you think? Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hey, Dave. It's Terry again.
Hi, Terry.
How we doing, buddy?
Well, pretty good. How are you doing?
Well, okay. Just enjoying the sunshine here.
Yeah, me too.
On this bill, or not bill, I don't know what it is, but this carrying guns in school.
Mm-hmm.
If they would start that, and I don't have any children in school that are all growing up, but if I did, I would pull them out of school, and I would either teach them at home or find a district or somewhere that's not going to, you know, can do that.
You don't think it's a good idea for teachers to have guns?
No, I don't like that at all. And I don't think it'll pass anyway. So,
well,
I mean, you're just asking for trouble.
All right, my friend. Hey, appreciate your thoughts on the subject. Thanks for sharing with us. Thanks,
Terry.
Thank you. 283-2525 is the number. Open talk, 283-2525. Hi there. Thanks for waiting. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
David, when you had the historian from Hannistown on the other day,
mm-hmm,
I was sorry that with the 4th of July weekend coming, she didn't mention the Hannistown Declaration. Now, this declaration was written 14 months before the Continental Congress wrote or pledged, you know, their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor, mm-hmm, to the Declaration of Independence. And 14 months before that, those stubborn Scots-Irish settlers in Hannistown said, "Resolved unanimously that the Parliament of Great Britain and the Ministry have attempted to reduce said inhabitants to a more wretched state of slavery than ever before existed in any state or nation. It is, therefore, become the indispensable duty of every American, of every man who has any public virtue or love of his country, by every means which God has put in his power, to resist and oppose that system of tyranny, that for us, we will be ready to oppose it with our lives and fortunes.
Wow. And that was in...
Now, that was 14 months before the declaration in Philadelphia.
That would be
and
early...
And I was just sorry that she hadn't mentioned it.
Early 1775, then, that would have been, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That would have been even before Lexington and Concord. They were, I think they were both in April of 75, if my history is, if I remember my history correctly, anyway. Wow, how about that? Hmm. That was fascinating, though, wasn't it, listening to her?
Oh, yes, it is, no? Because I know about this Hannistown because my ancestors include the Steeles, whom she mentioned as selling the lot, mm-hmm. the land.
Oh, really? Wow. Wow.
So, so that, but that Hannistown Declaration, I think, was very significant, but mostly forgotten.
I was I was not free to go down there for that weekend celebration. I'm going to go down sometime soon. I'd heard about Hannistown. I knew generally where it was, but I didn't know any of the history. I also found it fascinating that the town was burned to the ground.
Oh yes,
and it became buried under, was turned into farmland, and thus has become an archaeological time capsule. Which is, extremely fascinating to me.
Yes, Fort Ligonier has the most of the relics, I think. At least it's in that area, and they all retreated to Fort Ligonier.
Mm-hmm. That would have been a bit of a hike back in those days.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, especially when you start uphill in the Ligonier. Well, gosh, thanks for sharing with us. That's interesting information. Local history around here is just fascinating. Hannistown, there's Fort Necessity, down in the southern part of western Pennsylvania. All of the French and Indian War battles and the battle for Fort Pitt and, Fort Duquesne, which became Fort Pitt. We're rich in history around here.
Oh, yes, and people sometimes don't realize the significance of Route 40 and Route 30. Braddock's Road and Forbes Road. Mm-hmm. One was where Braddock came across, which was, and that's why the town Braddock, Pennsylvania.
Obviously named after him, yes. Mm-hmm.
And the other was the Forbes Road, which came across through Fort Ligonier and down to the point at Pittsburgh.
And you can still take Forbes Avenue.
You can still take Forbes Avenue.
And you used to be able to go, for people who have been around for a while, to Forbes Field and see the Pirates play. Also named after that general. You're right, General Forbes. Rich history, huh?
Very rich history. Yeah.
Let me ask you one question. You know what you're talking about here. One of my favorite books, in fact, I'm on my second copy of it because I literally wore out the first one, The Planting of Civilization in Western Pennsylvania. Have you ever come across that book?
Yes.
University.
Long. Well, I don't have a copy, but yes, I was aware of it.
University of Pittsburgh Press. I discovered it because I've always been fascinated in particular by the history of the Native American Indians around these parts. And that is dealt with in great depth in that book. If you're interested in Katanning Village and the Native American Indian trails and so on, many of which are now the paths of our major highways through this area. It's a fascinating book to read.
Yes, and the thing is, I'm a graduate of University of Pittsburgh, and this what I was quoting from was a paper that I wrote for an English course down there.
Wow.
Researched the history of Hannistown.
Well, until I talked to Lisa last week, the only thing I knew about Hannistown was I played golf there once. One of my golf matches when I was in high school was Annistown Golf Club. So as I told her, I figure it has to be pretty close to you. I don't know exactly where it is, but it's got to be in that area. Thanks much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to talk with you. Bye-bye. 283-2525 is the number. It was last week, wasn't it? We were talking with Lisa. Yeah, because their event was this past weekend down in Hannistown. They were marking their anniversary of the first English courts, the only English courts, for that matter, west of the Alleghenies back in those days. If you wanted to sue somebody, you had to go to Hannistown, the original capital of Westmoreland County. That's another thing we learned from Lisa. That was a good program. Coming up later on the program today, a discussion, and I plan to explore, actually, with guest Adrian Owen, what he calls the gray zone, the border between life and death. He is a neuroscientist researching the brain. He's in Canada. He's a professor at a university, a research university in Ontario. I'm not sure exactly where in Ontario. I think he originally studied in either England or Scotland. He'll be joining us a little bit later on the program. We'll talk about Into the Gray Zone. I can't imagine anybody who hasn't experienced maybe a family member or a close friend or somebody who's had some sort of impairment, brain impairment, whether it's a stroke, whether it's a traumatic brain injury from a bicycle accident. I was just reading a story in the Post-Gazette yesterday of a woman. She was a great athlete. She was one of those triathletes or something like that, you know, that was riding along a couple of years ago in Pittsburgh and went over the handlebars of her bicycle and cracked her skull and had all kind of incredibly serious medical problems for years and years and years. And she was the doctor said that was the reason they were able to save her life, really, because she was in such tremendous shape. She says, I don't even remember going over the handlebars. But a traumatic brain injury, stroke, also Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, which can be very debilitating. So what do these people, you know, as their quality of their life deteriorates, are they still aware of what's going on around them? Some of them can't speak. Or can't speak very well, or can't move, they're paralyzed. What are they thinking? Are they thinking? That's what we're going to explore with Adrian Owen coming up a little bit later on the program today. It's open talk right now, though. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525, and back to the people we go. Hi there, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hello?
Yes, hello. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Yes, just a quick point sure. About this gun discussion.
Please, yes.
I think it's a moot point because if the governor is going to veto it and the student union's against it, and like the other caller said, he'd take his kid out of school, I don't think it's worth debating. I think personally it's a good idea, though, because if you wanted to do something on a school ground and you knew people were armed, I don't think I would go in that direction. That's my point.
Okay. You think there's any danger about students getting a hold of guns if they're in school?
Well, if they're properly trained, as they're carrying them and they're concealed pretty well, I don't think there is an issue unless, of course, it's an accident somehow. But I don't think it would happen if they're properly trained.
Mm-hmm. All right. Appreciate your thoughts. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. 83-2525, gentleman who favors Senator White's legislation. I actually expressed these same reservations because I don't think there's any easy answer here, quite frankly. To me, it's not like a 2+2 question, you know, whether you're either right or wrong. It's either for or it's not for. Whenever some of the school districts around here started hiring armed security officials in the wake of the horrible tragedy up in Newtown, Connecticut, where the little kids, the kindergartners and the first graders were massacred. My question was, okay, so every building has an armed security officer. they can only be in one place at the building at a time, you know. Most school buildings, I mean, some are bigger than others, but most of them are rather large facilities. You know, if you're at one end of, even if it's an elementary school, let alone a junior high or a senior high, you know, how quickly are you going to be able to respond? Are you going to be able to respond if something develops in another building? Then there's the question of, are we creating an atmosphere that is making kids unnecessarily afraid? Now, yes, we've had many incidents of shootings in schools. But as a percentage of school buildings, is it that high? Now, admittedly, when you and I were in school, most of the people that I'm talking about here, this is something we never even thought of. Quite frankly, when I was in school, there were a lot of kids who brought, I don't think handguns, but during hunting season, I knew several kids who brought their rifles. The rifles were in their car. They would go hunting after school. Really didn't think anything about it, you know. If you were a hunter, okay. If you weren't, okay. Obviously, that would never happen today. But, you know, do we, what's that do to the mind of a second or third or fourth grader? You know, I mean, older students even for that matter, when we have armed security officers around. Or does it make them feel better? I don't know. There was at least one documented incident in a school where they permit this, and it is allowed, by the way, in some states, where a teacher left his gun, accidentally, of course, in the restroom while he was, who knows, washing his hands or whatever. And it was recovered by a student. And that's the sort of thing that people who oppose this bill worry about. 283-2525 is the number, 28, but there are obviously supporters. The last gentleman who just called us said he was in favor of it. 283-2525 is the number. According to the legislation, any school personnel who wanted to take a gun to school would be required to pass a psychological examination before they would be entrusted with a firearm in school. This is according to an amendment that was added at the last minute. The amendment also requires school boards to notify the local hospital and students' families when they give personnel permission to access firearms in school. So, well, that's okay. They also have to require school boards to file a comprehensive firearm safety plan with the law enforcement agency that has jurisdiction over the school. So you have to let the police know that, okay, teachers in this school have access to guns. Senator White himself said he thought the changes made it a stronger bill. Well, we'll see what happens. It's passed the Senate now. So it goes to the House next, the House of Representatives. And if it passes there, then it would have to pass, by the way, in identical form. If the House adds any more changes or amendments, it would have to go back to the Senate again. But then eventually it would go to the desk of the governor. He has said that, at least in its present form, he will veto it. Now, of course, you know high school civics class that you can override a veto if you have the right number of votes. I don't know what it's going to be in the House. Maybe it won't even pass in the House. I don't know. 28-22 is the vote in the Senate. I don't know whether that's enough to override a veto or not, but that's a possibility. 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. Open talk here on the It's Your Turn program. By the way, a little bit later on today, we're going to be talking a little bit about violence, and that certainly relates to the subject we've been talking about already, violence in our society, violence in schools, bullying. Bullying existed whenever I was in school. Those of you who are older, boomers or whatever, I'm sure you can remember that you had bullying when you were in school, right? In fact, in some of my classes, I don't remember all of them, but there were a couple of kids who were known to be bullies. You know, Joe Schmidlap, whatever his name was, he was a bully. I even knew of a couple who weren't even in my class. They were older by a year or two, and they were known around the schoolyard and the recess yard in elementary school. They were known as bullies. But, you know, back then you got maybe a bloody nose if you were bullied. You didn't get shot like happens so many times today. Some of the news you see in the major urban centers, Pittsburgh included, by the way, it's a rarity when you have a night pass without a shooting or two or three. It just seems to be the common thing to do right now. You get have an argument with somebody, you don't duke it out, you shoot them. Where's the respect for life, huh? We have another major story in our news today. This is the story of the mother who overdosed on heroin late last week. She was 7 months pregnant, then went into cardiac arrest. Her baby had to be delivered by C-section. The baby's not doing well at all. Last report I heard on a ventilator at a Pittsburgh hospital. And when I heard this story, and I read it several times this morning on the morning news, I didn't know whether to, I didn't know whether to be angry or to be sad. There's certainly, anger would be a logical emotion at this helpless child, not even born yet. 7 months in the womb, and sad. My sad feelings came from how could a mother do this? 7 months pregnant and put a needle in her arm and overdose on heroin. How could you do that? I was sad because you try to think it through. I mean, it's such a horrifying story. And I've never, thank God, I've never used heroin. I've never been tempted to use heroin. I have no idea what heroin does to you. I understand that it's incredibly addicting. How sad that you could be so addicted. So helpless, I guess. I mean, how else could you explain it, that you would feel such an incredible need to put a needle in your arm when you're 7 months pregnant? Is it a feeling somehow that all of these bad things that you hear about and read about are not going to happen to you? That you are somehow impervious to everything that we see and hear around us? Or don't you hear about these things? Don't you pay attention to the news? Don't you read the newspaper? How could you not be aware of the incredible number of deaths from heroin overdoses? How could you not be aware? That's why I say that's my sad emotion, my sad reaction to this. Mixed emotions with such a horrible, horrible story as this. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Open talk on the It's Your Turn program today. Here on It's Your Turn, 283-2525. Let me tell you about one of our sponsors on the program today. It's DBS Telecommunications. Have you heard of them? DBS Telecommunications. It's a local firm. We've certainly heard of them here at WISR and at Butler Radio because we utilize their services. DBS Telecommunications is a telephone equipment dealer and a data network installer, serving all over the Butler area and the Pittsburgh area, too. They sell, they install, they repair telephones for your office. They primarily install commercial telephone and voicemail systems. DBS Telecommunications has been around in the Butler area for the past 32 years. They've been around. They specialize in phone systems, in custom-designed networks, including fiber optics, the latest fiber optics. They specialize in high-quality hybrid digital telephone systems. 5-year warranties, by the way. They specialize in high-definition surveillance camera systems. Boy, but everybody has those now, right? Or wants to. They specialize in multi-door entry access systems. They specialize in overhead commercial paging as well. DBS Telecommunications. They also provide cabling for voice, data, and cable television wiring in both industrial and commercial applications. We, here at WISR and the Butler Radio Network, we use DBS Telecommunications. We utilize their services. We have for a long, long time. Call them today for more info. Phone number is 724-285-9088. 724-285-9088. Or check them out on the web at dbs-tel.com. dbs-tel.com. Open talk on the program today, 283-2525. 283-2525. Today is the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. 10 years ago today, the exact day, by the way, June 29th, 07, Steve Jobs walked onto the stage and held up the very first iPhone. Said, here it is, iPhone. Nobody had ever heard of it before, at least not to this extent. Now, there were cell phones. There were nothing to even compare with the iPhone when Steve Jobs held it up for the first time. And it's only 10 years ago, which astonishes me when you consider that they're everywhere today. Everywhere. Now, iPhone was the first really, you know, high-tech cell phone, smartphone. And, you know, now we have Samsung is the next biggest competitor, and there are a lot of people that like Samsung. Other companies make them. Smartphones, LG, Motorola, right? Yeah. But iPhone is the giant, and they were the first. And all of this has developed. I mean, you look around, you don't go anywhere today. Everybody has one, right? Everybody has one. Only within the past 10 years has that happened. 07. I mean, 07, it's not that long ago. First one today. Something else with an anniversary today, and we were talking about this on the morning show with my colleague Kate. The ATM, the automated teller machine, where you can go and get cash. Many of them are, you know, outside the wall of a bank or maybe inside the lobby of a bank. Now, there are freestanding ones, too. You can, you know, they're in supermarkets and other places. ATM machine, part of our culture today. First one unveiled 50 years ago today. And where do you think the first one was? England. I would never have guessed that. Barclays Bank in London unveiled the first ATM. They didn't call it that time. They had all kind of goofy names. Documatic and all kind of stuff. But, yeah, it was the first one. Here in the United States, in our area at least, PNC, what's now PNC, probably the first. They unveiled their first one in 1974. Before that, those of you of a certain age will remember this, if you wanted cash, if you needed cash, you had to go to the bank. Had to go to the bank and write out a check for cash. And then you'd give that to the teller, and they would give you cash. You old enough to remember that, Pat Parker? Yeah? And as a result, I did anyway at that time. You carried around a lot more cash than sometimes you were really comfortable with because you had to pay for it, pay for everything you bought. And if you ran out, you had to go back to the bank again. It's hard to imagine how inconvenient that would have been before we had the ATM machines, which are now everywhere. Yeah. It's one of those things, you know, you just take it so much for granted. And then you remember what it was like before we had them. 50 years ago, first one clicked into action in London, Barclays Bank. Still a pretty big bank over there, I think. Barclays? Yeah, that one year I got traveler's checks from them. They were a big traveler's check company. Nobody uses traveler's checks anymore, by the way. They're, I don't know whether they're completely kaput, but they're gone. I used to get mine from AAA. And, oh, I don't know, gosh, 7-8 years ago, I went to AAA to get traveler's checks. And, we don't have those anymore. And even if you did get them, I don't know where you can get them. Banks don't sell them anymore either. You used to be able to get them at a bank. I don't think you can cash them in a lot of places. The last time I tried, I could not. I ended up having to bring them home, and I had some left over from, like, previous vacations, you know. And I had to go to a bank and turn them in. The bank would take them, but nobody else would. A thing of the past, traveler's checks. Forget about it. They've gone the way of the horse and buggy. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. I tell you what we're going to do here. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be checking in with our first guest today, Adrian Owen. And we're going to be talking about the gray zone between life and death. It's an emotional subject, really, but fascinating to read about the research that Adrian Owen has done and that he has now written about. He calls it the gray zone, the border between life and death for people with some sort of either a traumatic brain injury or a degenerative disease affecting the brain. They're still alive. They're still breathing. Their heart's still beating. But are they really there? And to what extent are they really there? Can they hear us? If they can't talk or can't move. Interesting, huh? I'm looking forward to the chat. Adrian Owen, he'll join us next here on It's Your Turn. Right after these words, we'll be right back.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening. Every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Listeners, an absolutely fascinating topic to discuss here on the next segment of It's Your Turn. My name is Dave Malarkey. If you're just joining us, you're on It's Your Turn on WISR. Our guest is Adrian Owen. We're going to be talking about the border between life and death. Dr. Owen has written about this in a book entitled Into the Gray Zone. First of all, Dr. Adrian Owen, nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today, sir.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Dr. Owen, listeners, is an internationally recognized neuroscientist, and he is literally changing the way that science understands the consciousness of patients that perhaps in times gone by we would have thought of as being in a vegetative state. He's appeared on many national and international publications and TV shows to talk about this. How did you discover this new technique that you've been using, Dr. Owen?
Well, this is research that actually we've been developing over 20 years now. The first patient that we ever put into a brain scanner was about 20 years ago this month. So it's been quite a long road. And what we did is over time, we gradually developed the techniques so that we could understand more and more about some of these patients who I refer to as being in the gray zone, but clinically they often appear to be in a vegetative state. And the upshot of the science is that some of these patients actually turn out to have much more awareness than we previously thought. And in some cases that I describe in Into the Gray Zone, the patients are entirely conscious. They may have existed for decades in a situation where they're unable to move or to indicate that they are there, but in fact they've witnessed every conversation, every decision that's been made in their presence for sometimes many, many years.
This is a pretty emotional thing to read about in your book or even to talk about. I'm sure almost all of our listeners have experienced at one time or another a relative or perhaps a friend who has, for example, suffered a stroke, unable to move or to speak. And you wonder as you're visiting them whether or not they are hearing you, whether or not they're understanding, whether or not they're even aware of their surroundings.
Yeah, and these are some of the issues that I try to cover in the book. I mean, many people also will know somebody or will have a relative who has Alzheimer's disease. And again, this is a condition where it's not at all clear, particularly later in the course of the disease. The patients lose their personality, they lose their memories, they lose their ability to interact in a normal way with the outside world. And many of us are left wondering, well, what is left of this person, what's in there? And that for me defines the gray zone state. And I try and touch on all of these issues in the book. I would say it's not all bad news. There are some lovely stories in there of patients who have come back from the gray zone, stories of where the human spirit really has triumphed over great adversity. And I think we need to take all of that on board at once.
Listeners, a little bit about our guest, Adrian Owen, is currently the Canada Excellence Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience and Imaging at the Brain and Mind Institute at Western University in Canada. That's in Ontario, correct, sir?
That's correct, yeah.
As he mentioned, he's been working on this for years, in fact, the last 20 years, pioneering breakthroughs in cognitive neuroscience. I want to talk a little bit about how you do this, how you are able to communicate, in a sense, with the people that are in this state. But perhaps the best way for us to start is, in fact, the way you start your book with a very haunting story of a young woman, a very accomplished athlete, who suffered a traumatic brain injury. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Dr. Owen?
For sure. I mean, the reason I opened the book with the story of Amy is because, in many ways, she was a sort of perfect storm of the possibilities and the things that can happen to these patients. So she was a young athlete, as you've said, and she sustained a traumatic brain injury that left her in a vegetative state. And she was a patient for whom it was very uncertain what the future held, and there were difficult decisions being made about whether to continue to support her or whether it would be better to let her go. And she came here to London and Ontario, and we scanned her. And actually, contrary to all of the clinical signs, contrary to everything that people had thought up until that point, we were able to show that Amy actually was aware. And we put her into a brain scanner. We asked her, we said, because obviously she couldn't move, she couldn't squeeze my hand if I asked her, she couldn't move her leg if I asked her, but in the brain scanner we asked her to imagine that she was moving her arms around. And we know that that is associated with activity in a particular part of the brain, and for the first time in several months, we were able to deduce that Amy actually was aware, based on the fact that her brain activated exactly when we asked her to imagine moving her arms. She was able to do that on several occasions.
Wow. So then you were able to develop, and my technology, my words are primitive here, almost a code where you could see yes-no answers to questions?
That's correct. I mean, I wish I could tell you, you know, neuroscience is at the stage where we can put a patient into the scanner and just read their mind, and maybe they could just imagine a yes and imagine a no, and we could, you know, we could use that to ask them questions. But we're not quite there yet. But there are some things that people can do just by imagining them that we can very clearly see on the scanner. And one of them is to imagine waving your arms around it as though you were playing a game of tennis. It produces a very distinct pattern of activity. Another one is to ask a patient to imagine they're walking around the rooms of their house. Again, this produces a different pattern of activity. And what we typically do with these patients, and Amy was a good example of this, is we'll say, well, you know, imagine playing tennis if the answer is yes to this question, and imagine moving around your house if the answer is no. And in that way, I mean, it is, as you say, it's a little bit rudimentary, but it works surprisingly well. And patients who are entirely incapable of moving or blinking their eyes or doing anything at all can actually answer yes or no questions just by changing their pattern of brain activity in the scanner.
Yeah, and similar techniques have been tried before we had brain scans. I mean, with certain stroke patients, for example, if they had even limited muscle movement, you know, let's say in a hand, you could say, you know, if the answer is yes, squeeze my hand, and so on and so forth. But with total paralysis, obviously none of that would work. So how in the heck did you ever develop this? Was this a bit of serendipity when you hit on this idea?
This is why I ended up writing the book, really, because this has been a 20-year journey, and it's, you know, I've written many, many scientific papers over the years about this research, but I've never written a book for a lay audience. I really wanted people to have an opportunity to read about how these things come about, how they are discovered. And yeah, there's a bit of serendipity in there, there's a bit of good luck, there's a little bit of personal experience, things that were happening to me in my life that made me question, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be conscious? Mm-hmm. So all of these things sort of come together over a 20-year period. And in the early days, we really, I'll confess, and I do in the book, we really didn't know what we were doing. We were putting patients into scanners, and the widely held assumption was that this was a waste of time. No patient is ever going to produce any brain activity who's supposedly in a vegetative state. And we got a little bit of evidence from one patient that there was something there, and then that made us try a bit harder to tweak the technique so it was more accurate, and then we got another patient and so on and so forth. And the story sort of builds up to the point that we're actually communicating with some of these patients who are entirely non-responsive. And to be really honest, you know, I still find it incredible and amazing when I think about it. But, at the time, it was just we were doing what we did and pursuing what we thought was interesting.
Again, listeners, the title of the book is Into the Gray Zone. A neuroscientist explores the border between life and death. The author is Adrian Owen. We're talking to him right now here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll take a quick break. We have a bit more time to talk with him, and we'll pick up our conversation in a moment right after these words.
Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way. Getting there starts here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem, the bus will get you there, 'cause that's what we do. Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us,
the bus.
We're going your way.
Welcome back. Just joining us on It's Your Turn here on WISR today. That's fine. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Adrian Owen. We speak with him by telephone from Canada. He's the author of... It's a really fascinating new book called Into the Gray Zone, A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death, and a very emotional book. Let's go one more time back to the story of Amy, which is how you start your book, Adrian. She was in a hospital bed. She suffered the traumatic brain injury because she was shoved or pushed or something by an ex-boyfriend, and she hit her head on a piece of concrete, and that's what caused the brain damage. You say you were in a room with her, watching her. Her parents were there, and a couple of physicians, medical doctors, came in and said it seemed rather callous when they, you know, gave her a quick examination and said, well, Looks like she's in a vegetative state for us. That must have been horrific for the parents to hear. I was sitting right there, for goodness sakes. Turns out she actually wasn't once you started working with her.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, this is the sort of experience that I and many parents relatives in general have had many times. But I think the important point to emphasize is that, you know, these physicians weren't making an error, at least they weren't making a clinical error in the sense that patients like Amy do genuinely appear to be in a vegetative state. They had ticked all of the boxes, and this is really the amazing thing about how science and medicine sort of interact, in that it's just that we have tools and technologies available to us now that just aren't the clinical norm. So, you know, it is really important to understand that it's not that lots of errors are being made, it's that we're now living in a world where we can do things that we were never previously able to do. And that was the case with Amy. These clinical colleagues of mine didn't have available to them the neuroscientific tools that I had. So they made the best decision that they could, given the evidence they had.
By the way, patients, it's not just patients who suffer traumatic brain injury or stroke, listeners. This also involves people who, are battling a degenerative illness and disease, Alzheimer's. Parkinson's, by the way, also can affect the brain this way. You talk about, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, scanning and using brain scans. Is this different from what we would think of as a standard MRI? And if so, what's the difference?
A great question. So it's not different in the sense that the piece of equipment that we use, the MRI scanner, is actually the same. We just put it into a different mode for fMRI or functional MRI. So we can use the same machine these days to get a snapshot of the brain, a picture, if you like, of the structure of the brain, and that's what we use to assess where the brain damage is. But we can also use it in the fMRI mode to look at the brain activating and look at different areas of the brain responding or not responding in particular situations. And that in a way tells us what parts of the brain are functioning normally and what parts aren't. But it's essentially the same piece of machinery these days.
You have had, throughout your research, you've had a personal stake in this, Dr. Owen, involving a former girlfriend. Are you comfortable talking about that?
Sure. I mean, I wrote about her in the book. I think she was very important and crops up throughout the book. I mean, she is alive throughout the 20-year period that the book covers. And at the beginning of the book, we were already separated, but she had a brain aneurysm, a bursting of an artery in the base of her brain. Unfortunately, she was cycling at the time and crashed into a tree, and the combination of brain damage caused by all of these things left her in a vegetative state. And, this was at a time that I don't think I even knew what the term vegetative state meant. And, in many ways, this turned my attention to this condition and made me think, well, maybe with this experience that I have, this neuroscientific training that I have, maybe there's something that we can do that will be important for my former partner. And she crops up throughout the book because in many, many places, she survives for the 20 years of the book, and in many, always, it never comes out of a vegetative state, but at various points, she really made me think, what is it like to be her? What is her internal world like, and how does that relate to mine? So I think there were many occasions over that period where I pondered that, and in many ways she pushed me to continue working in that area.
I can understand that. This was not just this was pretty serious. I think you met her when you were in school, right? Both of you are still in school.
That's true. We were both in school. Yeah, we were pretty young. It was a very difficult time for me to deal with the two things at the same time, to be working in that area and to have somebody close to me who was in that condition.
Yeah, I mean, you could be, I don't think it's too strong a word, you could be almost haunted by the wonder of whether, even though she was still alive, whether she was still really there, right?
Yeah, well, the title of the chapter, the initial chapter about her is The Ghost That Haunts Me. And in many ways, I think you're right. It is a ghost that pushed me to continue to work in this area and continue to ask these questions. Had she died on that bicycle 25 years ago, it's entirely possible that I wouldn't be standing here talking to you today. And that is another element that I weave in and out of the narrative of the book, which is the things that bring us to where we are today are just so amazingly complex that it's very hard, even looking back over 20 years, it's hard to imagine how I got here to be talking to you today. And in many ways, it goes right back to that one accident on a bicycle 25 years ago.
We've talked about how emotional this can be for relatives and close associates. There are all sorts of ethical implications that your research touches upon as well, Adrian. Can you mention a few of those, please?
I can. I mean, obviously, understanding the diagnosis of a patient is of paramount importance. And, you know, many of these patients, everybody will have read in the media about cases where legal decisions are made about the prolongation of life or otherwise in some of these patients. And a lot of those cases revolve around whether the patient has any awareness or not. And I think probably a simpler way of putting it is that anybody listening to this would probably understand that you would make a different decision about somebody if you knew that they were aware and conscious than perhaps you might do if you thought they had no awareness of where they were and who they were and the predicament that they were in. So this technology really touches on that issue because it does put us in a position where we can improve the diagnosis. We can find some patients who one particular decision might be made if we didn't do the scan, and the decision might change based on the results of the scan. And I think that opens up a whole series of ethical issues that are going to require a lot of thought, I think.
I haven't been able to get through. I have a review copy of your book. I haven't been able to get completely through it yet, but the title of one chapter intrigues me. It's called Psychobabble. I was just doing a book review recently by another neuroscientist, the late Dr. Paul Kalanithi, and he talked about this when describing one of the patients that he had treated and how so delicate the various parts of the brain are that if one area is damaged, people will not be able to speak, but they can hear and understand. And then right next to that, another segment of the brain where if that's damaged, they can speak fine, but they won't be able to understand anything that you say. Fascinating and almost haunting.
It is, yeah. And I chose the word psychobabble to describe what I go through in that chapter, which is relating the science that we were doing at the time to everyday life. And, you know, many of the questions that we ask, no pun intended, you know, this is not rocket science. We just look at our everyday lives and try and design our studies based on what we understand about the world around us. And in that chapter, I described how we first started to understand how some of these patients may understand spoken language, whether or not they could understand what was being said to them. And we realized, well, you know, what's the difference between what you understand and what you don't? When you hear speech in your native language, as most people listening to this will be hearing right now, we understand it, we comprehend that. But when you hear speech in a foreign language that you have no experience of, suddenly you don't understand it, but it still sounds like speech. And we realized that if we could look at the difference in the brain between the responses to these two different types of speech you understand versus speech that you don't, then we may be able to get a handle on whether some of these patients understand language or not. And in fact, you know, it worked beautifully well, as I tried to illustrate in the book.
It's almost mind-boggling. It's a terrible phrase to use given what we're talking about, but I don't know what else to say. One final point. Can you look into the future? Who can? There's no crystal ball here, but it would seem there's all sorts of possibilities, some rather tantalizing ones. If this continues, augmented intelligence, even telepathy, is that out of the question?
I think telepathy in the way that most people think about it in science fiction is pretty unlikely to be round the corner. But various sort of versions of that, I think, are not too far away at all. I mean, we already have systems based on EEG or electroencephalography where, you know, if you wear a net of electrodes on your head, you can move a cursor around the screen. You know, I know there's a lot of interest in these sorts of things from the military and from the gaming industry because people want to be able to play games by just thinking about them, not actually moving their arms or you know, moving a joystick. So, and a lot of those things are present. I mean, I think people need to be very careful about what they go out and you know, and invest money and time in, because a lot of these, the things that really work are still very much in the laboratories and in the universities, and you can't yet buy an off-the-shelf machine that will allow you to, you know, read somebody else's mind. But, you know, I think these things aren't too far around the corner.
It's pretty provocative, folks, speaking to what it means to be alive. Dr. Owen has been featured on 60 Minutes. Maybe you saw him there talking about his research. He's also been published his research in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, and on and on. Adrian Owen, author of Into the Gray Zone, a neuroscientist explores the border between life and death. Is there a website people can find out more about you and your work, Doctor?
Absolutely. There is intothegrayzone.com. People go there. There's a lot of information about this work. There's also videos. In some of the documentaries and the TV coverage that you've just mentioned, I've put up there on the website so that people can actually see the patients, can see the technology, can see the MRI. They can see me communicating with a patient who supposedly was in a vegetative state. It's intothegrayzone.com.
That's fabulous, fabulous. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us today. Great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Bye-bye. One of our sponsors on the It's Your Turn program today, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Boy, these people do such good things for the needy and the less fortunate in our community. And a lot of volunteers. Man, the folks who volunteer down at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, pretty amazing. Can always use a little help down there, you know. Maybe an hour or two, or maybe some non-perishable food items, huh? And by the way, very soon now, they'll start collecting excess garden produce. Every Saturday morning, you can drop off any extra that you have, starting on July 15th. It's a couple of Saturdays down the road. Just take your excess produce from your garden to St. Michael's School Hall, right behind St. Michael's Church on Center Avenue. They'll have folks there, Society of St. Vincent de Paul folks there to collect it, and it'll be in the food bank on Monday. Pretty good, huh? Yeah, pretty good. And don't forget, too, when you're doing spring cleaning, you done with yours yet? Yeah, me neither. No, I'm on the way, though. Any items that you don't need or don't want or don't fit anymore, consider, don't just throw that stuff away. My goodness. We don't need to put it in the landfill to begin with. And number two, if you can donate it to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, somebody else can use those items. I'll be able to purchase it at a price they probably couldn't afford otherwise. Yeah. And they can put them to good use, and perhaps best of all, every single penny of the proceeds from the operation of the thrift store stay right here in Butler County. Every penny that goes to help support the food bank and the client aid program. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul, we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Our final guest on the program today, coming up, I have just a few minutes to chat with Andy Boyle, who's going to talk about adulthood for beginners. That's coming up in a moment here on It's Your Turn.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two is 5454. The pick three is 190190. The pick four, 2187. And the pick five, 85803. The wild ball for each of those is 5. And the treasure hunt, 1, 7, 16, 24, and 30. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to Mom, but a little over a year ago, we realized she couldn't take care of herself without our help. And, well, how could I not be there for her? I had no idea how hard it would be and just what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and, even for me, ways to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics that got me started, but also information about the hurdles I was facing in this new role. I could even connect with experts and hear from others who had been in my place. I know this road we're on isn't an easy one, but I'm really happy to have the extra help for her and for me. Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. This message is brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, listeners, we're going to be talking with Andy Boyle on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. And if you're just joining us, that's terrific. My name is Dave Malarkey. Andy Boyle visits with us on the telephone here today. Andy, nice to talk to you. Nice to say hi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andy has written a new book entitled Adulthood for Beginners, All the Life Secrets Nobody Bothered to Tell You. What inspired you to write a book like this, Andy?
So it was kind of that I wish a book like this existed when I had kind of entered the adult world. And when I kind of regularly give talks, I'm an adjunct teacher at a local college, and I kind of deal with a lot of young people, and they kind of always ask the same handful of life questions whenever I would give talks. And so I thought, hey, maybe I should just try to package all that up in a book to help people the same way I wish I could have been helped.
Well, many people will know you as a writer. You're also a comedian and a web developer. You say that many of the books that are written about starting out in life are either outdated, not relevant in today's world, or just plain wrong.
Yeah, I think very many of them come from this place of, I know all. Whereas I tried to write the book from, I hope that this will help. Let me show you some examples of where I made big mistakes, and hopefully you can learn from it. I think a lot of books, especially, I tried to be pretty funny. I tried to make jokes. I tried to make it more relatable. And that way, if you're reading it, even if you don't think the advice is necessarily the best, I at least tried to stay positive and upbeat and hope that that would help you out.
One of the bits of advice that you give is WWTHD, which stands for What Would Tom Hanks Do? What is this all about, Andy?
So I think when people think of celebrities who are kind of have always had like a relatively positive outlook, I think Tom Hanks is usually up there, because whenever you see Tom Hanks give an interview or do anything like that, he's always praising everyone else. He's usually downplaying his own actions. And he's trying to be as humble and kind as possible. And I think as you go through life, if you don't know how to respond to a situation, if you just think to yourself, well, what would Tom Hanks do right now? And if you do the same thing, you're probably going to end up okay.
So obviously you're aiming this at, 20-somethings, recent graduates, Andy?
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. You made it through your 20s. One of the things that you talk about in your book is your decision to stop drinking. Now, did you really do that, and why do you talk about it in the book?
Yeah, it's been about 3.5 years so far, and initially it was just going to be, I was just going to take a month off, and then after that month, I lost a ton of weight, I was sleeping better, I was more productive, my mood was better, and so I just kind of kept doing it, and I just kind of realized, I was just like, oh, I guess I either kind of grew out of the kind of, you know, go out, have a couple beers with your coworkers and have fun on the weekends kind of drinking that I did when I was younger. And so I kind of included that in the book as an example of life is about making experiments. And you can test those experiments and then see what happens. And for me, a big experiment, which I say I'm still going on, is not drinking. And so far, it's been going pretty good.
Do you think there are some 20-somethings who would consider this not relevant or outdated, this bit of advice?
They might. And again, I try not to come from a place of preaching or saying that anyone needs to do what I'm doing, but you know, I never thought of myself as having like a drinking problem. It was just kind of a time problem, and so I kind of cut that out, and then all of a sudden realized, wow, I have so many more hours to get a lot of stuff done, and also I have way more energy, which kind of led to me kind of eating healthier and working out and doing a lot of these other things that I think would be a little hard if I was kind of hungover on a Saturday.
We're talking, listeners, if you've joined us midstream here on this segment of It's Your Turn, we're talking with Andy Boyle about his new book, Adulthood for Beginners, All the Life Secrets That Nobody Bothered to Tell You. You obviously didn't know a lot of this stuff whenever you were starting through your 20s, Andy.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's kind of one aspect of how I thought about writing the book, which was, what are some of the bigger mistakes that I wish somebody had kind of given me some of this advice? And I think there's probably instances where my parents definitely tried to walk me through things and give me advice, but I did not listen because I was young and I knew everything. And I think with a little bit of age and time, and humility, that kind of helped to show me, oh, there's definitely a lot of these things that I should have either listened to or had to discover myself, which hopefully folks who read this book, they can learn from my mistakes and hopefully be able to make a little bit better decisions.
There are some practical things, some practical advice in your book. Do you talk about what you should and should not do in the workplace, for example? Might be quite a bit different from your undergraduate experiences.
Oh, yes, definitely. I think one of the big things is that you have to understand that even if you are hired and people think that you have the skills, you still have to regularly prove to them that you're worthy of the responsibility. So, like when I started out, I thought I was, you know, a hot shot. Like if they hired me, they must think I'm awesome. But it actually took a long time for me to actually prove I was as awesome as I thought I was before they would give me the responsibility to do the things that I believed I had deserved, when in fact I hadn't done anything to actually earn their trust and respect to get those higher level projects. So that's one of the really big things, as well as just how to manage up and deal with coworkers and try to be as positive and cheerful in the office as possible.
Again, on the practical side, there's a big difference when you go into your 20s and you're a recent graduate in terms of dating and personal relationships. Do you touch on these subjects, Andy Boyle?
Oh, yeah, I do definitely. I go through a lot of things about how to ask someone out, you know, how to deal with rejection, how to deal with breakups, and just like kind of a lot of these other, you know, kind of advice for do's and don'ts that I think will save people a lot of emotional grief and also kind of help them think about relationships in a more empathetic way. Even if they end, I think there's a good way to be able to treat others with respect and kindness throughout that. And also just like coming at it from a place of caring about the other person, I think goes a long way, which, you know, took me years to learn.
What would Tom Hanks do? I don't know whether Tom Hanks would ever have been rejected for a date, though, Andy.
I'm sure he would answer that and say that he has been, and he's a better person for it.
On the more serious side, you contend that to have a really healthy life, you have to explore your creativity when you're at this age.
Exactly. I think that you should be always trying to create something outside of yourself. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to, you know, you don't have to write, you don't have to be on a stage. You can take a woodworking class, which I'm doing right now. You could join a church choir. You could pick up a guitar or a banjo or piano. You could paint. There's so many different things that you can do that involves actually creating something outside of yourself. And I think it's not only therapeutic for your brain, but it's also like a great way to relax and just kind of relieve stress. But also it's a way to create something that exists outside of your mind.
From a practical standpoint, what do you think is something that the current workplace cares about that 20-somethings don't realize, and something that may very well be hurting their career long term?
This might sound like a silly thing, but how messy your desk is. One thing that I discovered throughout my career was I would always have people make little comments about how messy my desk was, or, hey, maybe you should throw away those, you know, cans of soda that you have on your desk, not realizing that that was a boss saying, throw away those cans of soda. And when you kind of start noticing those who kind of have a little bit more success, usually their desks are a little bit cleaner, a little bit more regimented, and people don't view them as messy or sloppy. And so when I started cleaning my desk and making it look nicer, I 100% could tell that people treated me with a different level, a better level of respect.
Andy Boyle's writings, listeners, have appeared in, Esquire, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, New York Times, and many other places. And he's also pretty funny, and there's a lot of humor in this book along with practical advice. The title of the book, once again, is Adulthood for Beginners. Where can we find the book, Andy Boyle?
You can get it at most major bookstores as well as online at Amazon. You can even get it at Target.com, Barnes & Noble, so many other places. Support your local independent bookstores, though, if you can.
Andy Boyle. Andy, nice to meet you. Thanks for being with us for a few minutes here today. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks to Andy. Thanks to our earlier guests. Certainly appreciated our conversation with Adrian Owen today about Into the Gray Zone. Guests tomorrow, Janice Rogers will be here. You know what LIFE is? I'm talking about LIFE Butler County, L-I-F-E. Janice Rogers is the enrollment manager for LIFE Butler County. She's with Lutheran Senior Life. She'll be here to fill us in, tell us all about it. Also, we have another guest with us on tomorrow's program as well.